Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. All right, this is probably one of the coolest segments that I've ever done, other than the battlefield studies and the post-traumatic winning stuff that we've done. The series that we started with General Van Riper entitled On Discipline has turned more heads, has got more attention, has created more conversation than just about anything we've done. And joining me is a man who's partly responsible for the creation of All Marine Radio, although I've never said that in public to him before. But he changed my life, and ultimately all the lives that this has impacted were changed by a decision that he made. So joining us, retired Lieutenant General, United States Marine Corps, Dennis Halick. Sir, first of all, thanks for doing this. Welcome to All Marine Radio.
Well, thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, before we get into our discussion here, I need to hear your side of it. I still have a letter in my home that's framed that you wrote, a note that you wrote me. And I got a phone call when I reapplied to be appointed, when Paul Kennedy, who just retired this week, and Dave Furness called me and said, "Hey, we're going to war and we could probably use your help. Are you still in the reserve?" And I said, "I'm not really sure. I don't get too much mail anymore." And, and I wasn't. So I applied to be reappointed. And Brigadier General Halick was, I believe, sir, was chairing that board. And I got a call from a major by the name of Miller, who told me, "Mac, just want to give you a courtesy call. We've done our preliminary cut. Your name is not on the list to be reappointed. Wanted to give you a courtesy call and tell you." And I asked why. I said, "I have a pretty good OQR there." And he said, "Oh, no, that's not the question." He said, "You have one of the better ones." He said, "It's just, you know, will you have enough time to retire and whatnot?" And now it's not going to work. I said, "Okay." And then the same guy calls me maybe a week later, and he says, "Well, you're not going to believe this. This has never happened, but the general put your name on the list, and you're going to be reappointed." So can you fill in the what happened between those two phone calls, sir?
Yeah, absolutely, Mac. And, you know, I remember that distinctly, you know, especially when you and I talked about it earlier. You know, what happened was everybody, you know, like the major said, you had a great OQR. But, you know, you reach this threshold at 17 and a half years where the Marine Corps doesn't like to take you because it becomes a retirement issue. And then you're stuck with it, if you will. And frankly, that really used to make me angry because what we were doing is we were taking quality officers, you know, that had served faithfully on active duty and in the reserve Marine Corps. And we weren't letting them come back on duty when we needed their skill set because of this stupid rule that we had about reaching the 17 and a half year cycle because we didn't want to pay those kind of guys retirement after the 20 year mark. So, you know, and I got a lot of pushback, quite frankly, from the other members of the board. And when I, you know, just look at your record and what you got off the Marine Corps, I didn't care. There's a reason why you're the president of the board. And it was my call. And, you know, running back into you in Fallujah in 04, I mean, it was exactly the right call. And the things that you're doing today for the Corps, it was more than the right call. It was a great call. But it was because of what you had done, not really anything that I had done except push the envelope a little bit on what I thought was a stupid rule.
Hey, sir, I need to stop. The audio is just a little bit muffled. So
okay.
That's better right there.
Okay.
Okay. No, just keep it right there. Now, is there any truth? General Nello tried to take credit for part of that. He said he got stopped in the hallway, and you asked him about it and said, "Hey, what's the deal? You wrote a letter for McNamara. And is it any truth, or is he just taking credit for your hard work?"
Yeah, there is some truth to that because he had a letter in there, and I did run into the hallway and said, you know, at the time, obviously, we were in the first name station, says, "Hey, Bob, do you know this guy? And what do you recommend that we do with it?" And he goes, "Yeah, I know him. He's a great Marine, and, you know, if you have the shot to bring him aboard, bring him aboard." So, yeah, he deserves some of the credit.
Here, I just here all these years, I just thought he was grandstanding. I'll have to thank him. So let's talk about your career before we talk about discipline. Born and raised where?
Well, born and raised in Garner, Iowa. It's a small farming community up in northern Iowa. Graduated from high school in 65, and like a lot of us, you know, attempted to go to college, but didn't do well because, frankly, you know, I didn't go to very many classes and too much partying, and so I was one of those guys that got drafted, and this was even before the lottery. So I got my greetings, your friends and neighbors have selected you to serve in the Armed Forces of the United States. And that was Christmas of 67. So I was supposed to report in January of 68, and I went to see the recruiter, the Army recruiter, just to see what else, you know, there's anything else that I could do to talk to me. He did nothing. He just said, hey, it's the draft, you're going to. I was walking by the Marine recruiter and just stuck my head in, and he kind of looked at me and goes, what do you want? And I said, hey, you just maybe thinking about, you know, enlisting and not going to the draft. And he goes, I'm not so sure we can use someone like you, but come on in anyway. And the rest is history. I enlisted and spent 5 years as an enlisted Marine, and I got out as a sergeant and went back to school, joined the TLC program. It's amazing how much you grow up, and was commissioned in 75 as an infantry officer, and kind of the rest is history. I did the normal things infantry officers did. MAP, you know, I was a rifle company commander, weapons company commander. I was an S4 logistics officer, commanded 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines. I commanded the 1st Brigade in Fallujah, but more so as deputy 2MEF. And, you know, I stood up my stock, had my 4COM, I had 2MEF with all great commands, and had some good staff time, instructor at AWS, and just kind of the normal things that infantry officers do. But it was a great career. I loved it.
How does the Marine Corps get on your radar? Was there anything in your family, sir, that pointed you towards the Marine Corps, or was it something, as you just evaluated the services, you thought the Marine Corps would be a nice fit? Because the Marine Corps is not a great presence in the Midwest, unless there's an INI that happens to be in the city. But that's Army country and Air Force country. How did the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, that's a great question, because you're exactly right. I mean, in northern Iowa, other than the recruiter, which is about 30 miles away, you really didn't see any Marine. I'd always admired the things they had done and read quite a bit of stuff about World War II in the Pacific and then in Korea. You know, I followed Ray Davis a little bit, General Davis, even then, you know, when I was in high school. But I really didn't have much desire to enlist in the Marine Corps until I got drafted. And then when it came right down to it, you know, I just said, hey, if I got to serve, I'm going to serve with the best. So I enlisted in the Marine Corps.
You know what? It's amazing how powerful our propaganda is. Honestly, yeah. I mean, because you hear that story so many times that I had seen the Marine Corps. I was always impressed with it. And if I was going to be a part of something, I wanted to be a part of something the best. And in all of that ignorance, knowing very little about the Marine Corps, but knowing what they saw, they joined the Marine Corps. So pretty interesting. Talk to me about, if I were to ask you, give me two highlights of your career, what would they be?
I think probably being the officer in charge of the security force ashore in Beirut, Lebanon in 1984. We had a mixed security force, if you will, off the amphib ships with infantry and, you know, mortarmen and so on and so forth, and a lot of logistics, 150-man force. That was a highlight. Obviously, commanding 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines is a highlight. And then standing at MARSOC in October of 2005, you know, and taking them that first leg, that was probably the most fun that I had. Although, you remember, the Marine Corps wasn't exactly enamored with Special Forces at the time. But those three
no need to sugarcoat it. We weren't exactly enamored, That might be a little bit of sugar on that. The Marine Corps always consider itself, special operation capable. And why do we need to be separate, right? Why do you got to leave us?
Right.
We're not so much. As you look at their development, give me some thoughts. I mean, special operations now are so much a part of what we do to the point that, a lot of people look at them and say, because they exist on the dark side of the planet, they can be used in a way that not a whole lot has to be said, and they probably get tasked maybe too much now. I'd be curious about your thoughts about their development since you've left.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I remember talking to General Brown, who was the commander, Special Operations Command at the time, and obviously as one of his components, I belong to him, and he told me at the time when we were first standing up, he said, "Hey, Danny, I think that within 10 years that, your Marines from MARSOC will probably be one of the most sought-off forces." I kind of looked at him and said, "I'm thinking more like 6. And this was in early 2006. I was just down there last month. General Yu had all the former commanders down for about a day conference. And to watch what they've become and how far they've accelerated, from me to Maston Robinson to Paul LeFevre to, Mark Clark to Jody Austin and so on and so forth, they accelerate, I think, with each commander. They lead the way in technology, especially when it comes to IT and C2. They're very, very good at what they do. And I think they're one of those forces. If the Marine Corps, and I really believe this, the Marine Corps needs to spend more time with MARSOC and make sure they're more integrated with the conventional force and vice versa. Because the conventional force of the Marine Corps and the MARSOC have a lot to provide or give to each other.
I want to ask you one more question about your experience. Let's talk discipline. And I'll kind of weave it into that. You come into the Marine Corps during Vietnam, and I'm curious about your thoughts, because so you've seen us move in and out of conflicts a number of times throughout your career. You see this General Furness's letter to the division gets public, and this big brouhaha starts about it. I'm curious about your thoughts. You saw that. What did you think as somebody with almost 40 years of experience in the Marine Corps? What did you think when you saw that controversy brewing about discipline, chicken shit, what are we doing here? I'm curious about your general thoughts when you first saw it.
Yeah. My first thoughts were, I kind of shook my head. I read the letter and I heard all the negative comments and some of the good comments, and I just shook my head and I go, some things never change. Some people think that discipline and good order and being a unit, a strong unit based on order and discipline, is chicken shit. So I kind of shook my head. And let me take you all the way back to 1968. Because when I first enlisted in the Marine Corps, and I retired 42 years and 5 months later, when I first enlisted and went to my first duty station, back in 1969, Marines were putting speed into the coffee pot. Marines were coming to work absolutely stoned. And I used to sit there and being, an Iowa farm kid, I was so naive, I didn't even know that stuff was out there. So it goes all the way back to that kind of discipline. And then when I was commissioned in 1975 and I was out at Camp Pelton in the 1st Marine Division, it was not unusual, and I think you remember some of this, Matt, to see a cross burning on the parade deck, to have fights in the mess hall. We carried 45s on duty, and as a second lieutenant on duty, and of course I had 5 years experience by that time, I made sure that my staff NCO was the biggest guy I could fight, and he carried also a 45. We had fights in the mess hall, we had fights in the barracks, we had drugs in the barracks. So there wasn't any good order and discipline. And the person that really cleaned that up was General Wilson, the Expeditious Discharge. And that made a huge difference in the Marine Corps. And then if you leap forward, you know, coming all the way, Beirut, Lebanon, you know, we were in and out of there three times, and I think you well remember at the time, the 8th Marine Regiment was the only one that was really doing anything during the 80s, and I was lucky enough to be part of 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines.
No, the rest of it, the rest of us hated 8th Marines. Because it was true. The rest of us were all the static display on the east, west coast in Hawaii and Okinawa, and 8th Marines is romping around the Mediterranean, the Caribbean, doing everything. It's like, what the hell, man? So, again, quit sugarcoating stuff, sir. We hated you guys.
You're right, because I had two pumps to Beirut, and we did Norway, we did the Carib, and we did Cuba. I mean, we did a lot of things. But the other side of that was is because, you know, the Marines thought they were so shit hot because they were doing things that other Marines weren't doing, there was also a discipline issue there. And you really had to, well, I don't want to say keep your thumb on it, but you had to make sure that you were talking to your lieutenants and your corporals and your sergeants all the time. So, you know, that people don't realize that, I think, because, you know, it was kind of an 8th Marine show at the time. Then coming out of Desert Shield and Desert Storm, you really didn't see it that much, only because, you know, the buildup was so long and the fight was so short. But I really noticed it, I think, the most, Mac, when I first took over MARSOC and was out at 2nd Battalion at Camp Lejeune at Stone Bay. And we'd only been stood up, I guess, for a month. And you know how that all worked. We took force retirement into 2nd Battalion, Raider Battalion now. And I was in listening to a class, and I was with the sergeant major, and they didn't know I was back there, and I didn't want to interrupt the class. And I looked around at the Marines. I saw everything in their uniform line. I saw Nomex jumpsuits. I saw sleeves half rolled all the way up, some halfway down, some no shirts on at all, some real long hair, some real long mustaches, some high in tights, some wearing boots, some wearing tennis shoes. It was absolutely amazing to me. And that's not a dig on recon. That's kind of a dig on the way our culture was as we were coming out of Desert Shield, Desert Storm, then obviously into OIF and OEA. We just forgot everything except fighting. And everyone thought that, hey, if you were a war fighter, everything else went, you know, by the way. Bad, bad decision culture-wise for the Marine Corps.
I want to... This is kind of it's not an aside, but it is an aside. I think that one of the things I've said about this whole debate is if you look at our culture, a culture that doesn't do consequences, that doesn't do discipline, that tries to protect young people from adversity, the step to join the Marine Corps now is a bigger relative step than it was for you and I when we grew up with all of our coaches and most of our teachers were veterans that were men, right? Right? And,
right.
Right? If you played football, right, your head was a weapon, right? You didn't need a water break. You'll get the water break after you run the play, right? Because we can do this without water, boys. So we grew up in a different culture and a little bit rougher culture. Now that step is a huge step. And if you look at around the DOD from the 7th Fleet, and the collisions they've had, and if you've read the excerpts of investigations that appeared in print, it's frightening in terms of the lack of discipline. You look at some of the incidents that special operations community is currently dealing with today. A community that grew really fast and got really big, and probably if we weren't at war for such a long period of time, would not have had those kind of requirements placed on it, but they did. And if we as Marines look around and say, if we don't have a discussion about this, we're whistling past the graveyard, because we're crazy if we don't talk about how much of our culture can we absorb if we're supposed to locate close with the Chinese, the Russians, or the Iranians. How much of that, how much of this stuff can we absorb before we have to say we can't do that and still do this? So I'm curious about your thoughts about, you know, our culture. You just mentioned our culture. So our culture is getting more, is softer and softer. And I just say that as a statement of fact with no editorial comment. I'm sure there's great reasons for it, but it's a big transition when you do join the military, especially an organization like the Marine Corps that doesn't particularly historically care about your feelings. And how do you navigate that, sir? And is it, I mean, for us not to have this conversation, to me, is crazy because this is integral to what we do.
Well, first of all, Mac, you're absolutely right. And, you know, unfortunately what we have now is we have two cultures. We have the culture that our young people grow up in, and social media has made a huge impact. Not all bad, and you and I both know that, but a huge impact where they don't talk to each other. They talk to each other through texting or tweet or whatever it happens to be. I see it in my grandkids, and I see it in the young people. Then we have the Marine Corps culture. And I've actually heard some people say, Marines, retired and on active duty, saying that the Marine Corps culture needs to be more like the civilian culture, if you will. That's the only way we're going to succeed. I totally disagree with that. You know, our whole purpose in the Marine Corps is to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. You can't do that by having a culture that is so wrapped into social media and is so disengaged from one another, you would have no teamwork. You might as well have a union force like you do in some of, you know, the Netherlands countries and Norway and Sweden and some of those. You can't ever do that. So when I hear something like that, I take them to task right away. Because if you do something like that, you're lost. If you don't have these discussions, you're lost. Here's a prime example for you. In 2009, when I was 2MEF, we had the same discipline problems that, you know, Dave Furness is going through right now. It's nothing new. It's nothing new at all. And, you know, anybody who's been in the Marine Corps more than 4 years knows it. It goes all the way back to, you know, the Banana Wars, World War I, so on and so forth. We were having a real problem, and everyone says, yeah, it's the corporal's fault. And I said, yeah, maybe it's the corporal's responsibility. It's not his fault. And maybe it's the sergeant's responsibility. But what are our lieutenants doing? What about first and second lieutenants doing? They're leaders. You know, we don't call them platoon commanders, or some people do. They're platoon leaders. So I got all the lieutenants in the mess together. I had to brought them all in theater and Camp Lejeune, and I probably had 80%, 90% of all the lieutenants in the mess there. And I got up on the stage and was talking to them, and I invited the regimental commanders and the division commander, so on and so forth, but they needed to sit in the back and they couldn't ask anything or they couldn't say anything, and they agreed to that. It turned out really well. So I started asking some of the lieutenants, I go, tell me what you do during the day. And you get the typical, well, you know, sir, I'm a maintenance guy, so we work on tanks, so, sir, I'm a platoon commander, platoon leader, so, you know, the staff sergeant is doing this and I'm doing that. And it goes on and on. I says, how many of you have a platoon leader's notebook? Mac, you should have seen the look I got. Now, whether you have it on, you know, electronic notebook or whatever, I don't care. Hardly any of them did.
What?
Hardly any of them.
Sir, come on. If you want attention, I'll give it to you. You don't have to make up crazy stories. The I can get, if you want Lance Corporal Nick Ratiff from Charlie 3rd Platoon, Charlie 1-5 in 1984, if you want his Social Security number, height, weight, and home of record,
exactly.
I'll give it to you right now. It's sitting right next to me.
It got worse than that.
Yeah.
So I said, how many of you go to the mess hall? And, you know, and I was very upfront with him. I said, look, this isn't going anywhere. It's just between you and me and, you know, the lieutenant. Very few raised their hand. How many of you go to the barracks? I had a lieutenant stand up and tell me, Carl Winston, too, because I was looking at his ribbon. He goes, sir, that's not our job. That's the staff sergeant's job. My job is to make sure that they're trained properly. Okay. And what if their room is just way out of order? And they're not doing their boots properly, or the utilities, or their haircuts, then how do you expect them to train if they don't feel good about themselves? You know, he really didn't have anything to say about that. I said, how many of you go to the barracks on a Sunday afternoon and see what your Marines are doing? Now, there was probably 400 or 500 lieutenants in there. I bet you 10 raised their hand. So, I mean, if we think that this is all a sergeant and corporal fault, if you will, put quotation marks on that, you know, we're sadly mistaken. Because, yeah, we've got to have this first and second lieutenant and the captains to some extent, because they're our leaders. They have to be engaged with those sergeants and those corporals, or we'll never get any better. Okay, off my high horse on that one.
No, well, no, I mean, but sir, I think we all know that Marines are blank canvas. They will be what we require and what we inspect. And so to me, when people say, "Well, you're dumping on enlisted Marines," no, I'm not. We know that this is a we, not a they event. All right, this is on us. This is on the leaders of the Marine Corps. And I have a son. Both my sons have been in the Marine Corps. My oldest is going to MCCC down at Fort Benning, all fired up last week when he moved down there because evidently Fort Benning's got a number of recreational shooting ranges. And so he said, "Dad, this is going to be better than I thought." And so we were talking, and he said, "Any advice as I head out to, you know, school and then company command?" I said, "You know, I don't know who uttered the words, expect what you inspect, but if you inspect your barracks on a weekly basis, if you inspect your weapons, if you inspect your vehicles, let me just tell you what, right? Marines will do what you require them to do. Okay. They will do that and you will be a performer. But if you don't inspect, God help you. God help you." And so I'm curious your thoughts. This is not a junior Marine problem. It's not, oh, they're not as good as we used to be. It is everybody needs structure. Everybody needs the sixth step in troop leading. Everybody needs to be inspected. And, I mean, you commanded at some pretty high levels, sir. Does that ever change?
No, it really doesn't. And let me make something perfectly clear, too, and I know you agree with it. The Marines of today are as good, if not better, than the Marines of yesterday. You know, it's my experience, it goes all the way back to Vietnam and then all the way up to the present. They're smart, they're engaged, they want to be challenged, and they'll do what's expected of them if you're the type of leader who holds them to task. And again, it gets back to, you know, the lieutenants and the captains and the sergeants and the corporals. But it never really changes. You know, that issue with 2 months, if that isn't carried on consistently, you know, from commander to commander or sergeant major to sergeant major or command man, chief command man, you lose it. And pretty soon they're back to, well, you know what? I can look like a stack of rocks, if you will, and I don't have to do this and I don't have to do that. Good grief. I remember walking into the PS once at Camp Lejeune, and there was this Lance Corporal in there with his cub around walking around the PX. I'll bet you, Matt, that he bypassed at least 4 staff NCOs and a couple of officers, and no one said anything to him. Well, what kind of example does that set? I mean, that's the whole crux of the problem. So, no, it never, no matter what level you're at, I'm sure the time on Marine Corps, it's the same issue with them. Mind your Marine Corps commanders, your division commanders, your component commanders, you know, so on and so forth. It's just something that we have to stay with all the time. I am a firm believer in, you know, I kind of want to say, you know, I don't know if I'm a compassionate leader or not, but I'm probably a leader with empathy, because I was prior enlisted and we all come up through the ranks. But at the same time, you know, tomfoolery and nonsense is exactly that. It's nonsense. And if we continue to do this, we would just turn into any other second-rate service, take it around the globe, doesn't matter.
Talk to me about the notion that, the whole notion that this is chicken shit, that we can somehow or other turn it on, we cannot be very disciplined in garrison, but somehow or other, when we go forward, we'll turn it on because we'll be able to know what's important. We'll apply ourselves there, and we'll be a good unit when we fight. Talk to me about selective organizational discipline, if you will.
Sure. First of all, you know, when you hear that word like, this is chicken shitter, this is bullshit, if you sat there and you talked to an individual, I was a battalion commander, we were out in the field, and I was walking around talking to some of the troops in one of the rifle companies, and he was doing a machine gun fighting position. And the Lance Corporal there was helping the private, and he was brand new, do it. And I said, what you doing there, Lance Corporal? He goes, well, sir, I'm digging this stupid machine gun pit, and it's really stupid because we've done it 1,000 times, and I don't know what the hell we're doing this for. So I turned to the PFC and said, what's your name? He tells me, Dan. He goes, give me your left limit, your right limit, what you're supposed to be doing, what the dimensions are. And he just looked at me like he didn't have a clue. I looked back at the Lance Corporal and goes, okay, sir, I get it. So, you know, that's part of the chicken shit thing. And if you don't explain to them why you're doing something, you know, and you can do that most of the time, then they do perceive it as chicken shit. When I was a younger Marine, and I know you were the same way, Matt, you know, some of the things we did, like junk on the bunks and those kind of things, I did think they were hot and necessary, if you will, because I had one set of gear for inspections and one set of gear for the field. Does that make any sense to you? I mean, it just didn't. So,
no, but that's what they told. That's what they told us to do. So that's what we did.
Exactly. The other side of that, though, is this: what I found as I was growing up in the Marine Corps, that those kind of things, although I didn't always understand them and I didn't always agree with them, they instilled in me a certain discipline and a certain organizational skill that I knew that I had to be ready to go all the time. And even as a young captain, I could look at a fellow rifle company and I could tell how good they were in the field by what they looked like in garrison, by how the police call was in the area, by how much junk was in the parking lot, by how many people put their hands in their pockets as they were walking around, how many people didn't salute. I could tell you, and we beat them every time on a McCress. You could see it. And then you take it to combat. I'll never forget the Dark Horse Battalion, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, when we were in, I guess this was Afghanistan. And I was talking to their battalion commander, great, great American. And his troops just looked like crap. So, and I was a 1-star at the time. I'm sorry, I was a 2-star at the time. And I was sitting there talking to him about it. And I said, you know, your troops look pretty scruffy. He goes, hey, sir, we just got done with it up. He goes, you come back tomorrow, you're going to see a totally different battalion. So I did. And didn't say anything to him. He was exactly right. They were squared away. They were cleaned. Everything was policed. They had the haircuts. They were washing their utilities in one of the rivers that was nearby. And as you well remember, the Dark Horse Band, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, were very, very successful. They had casualties, quite a few, but they were a really fine fighting unit. And that's because they had organizational structure. They had good order and discipline. They had leaders that talked to the youngsters. All the things that, you know, the corporals and lance corporals expect. And we don't always do it.
I want to ask you about the kind of the cyclical. It was interesting listening to General Van Riper. I don't know if you – did you listen to that interview, sir?
I did.
What did you think? Anything out of that interview strike you as you listened to it? Because General Van Riper, he went down this road too. And, I mean, he became much like General Furness, he became a marquee player. Like, people said discipline and somebody would yell Van Riper. And not all of us understood it. Listening to General Van Riper, what stood out about that interview to you?
Well, you know, I love General Van Riper, and I think we all do. And I had to kind of chuckle because, you know, he was talking about standing lights that were on, and that rated you an inspection. And by the way, those inspections are usually on Saturday. They weren't during the week. And I thank God I was never a recipient of that. But then I was a student going through Command and Staff College when we had the Marine Corps University. And I'll never forget, he made us go out in, not made us, he highly recommended that we go out and run a PFP and then come back and write a flag order. And we all go, what the hell? Because, you know, this must be a rip thing, if you will. But you know what? After we did that and we got back, we found out how hard it was to do something like that when you were tiring. And, you know, even as majors, that was a good lesson learned. The other thing that stood out with General Van Riper is, and I didn't know that he had been around, you know, that much earlier than I was, but it amazed me that the things that he saw and the things that he did and how he affected good order and discipline had really not changed. I think what has changed, Mac, the most, and General Van Riper didn't say it, you kind of said it, is we don't talk about it. We don't talk about leadership. We don't set enough with our lieutenants and our captains and our corporals and our sergeants and our staff NCOs. We don't do that enough. And a lot of officers will think that's interfering. It's not interfering. It's called leadership. So that's the thing that impressed me most about General Van Riper.
You know, I've listened to that interview a couple times since then, and hearing him talk about his experience with my company 3-7 and hearing the numbers, now that we're talking about peer-to-peer warfare and near-peer warfare, I mean, the last time we did that was with the North Vietnamese Army, 1967, 1968, and into 69. But in the northern end of I Corps, Con Tien, Leatherneck Square, Khe San, I mean, fighting up in those mountains, I mean, those were incredible physical fights. And they were not afraid to arteous, mortar us, you know, use Bangalore torpedoes to breach our wire, use flamethrowers against Delta 1-4 at Con Tien. And so you go back and you look at that, and then you hear him talk about 74 Marines in his company were killed in action while he was there, and 100%, over 100%, were casualties when you put all the Purple Hearts that they had over the course of the year together. And that number, that's a sobering number. And then he talks about, look, the discipline that I learned came right out of that, right? And it's not for show. It is for go. If you're going to be disciplined in the face of a determined enemy that is going to come and put your head on a stick, you better have your ass and your brain wired together, and it better be wired tight, or else more people are going to die. And to me, it was really that point seared home, because I grew up with those. I came in the Marine Corps in 1983, went to OCS, and everybody was a Vietnam veteran that was a staff NCO or an officer. Just about everybody was. And so we got raised on their hardness, and they were hard. My second regimental commander was Marty Brantner, and as a colonel, right, he just passed away, and yeah. But he had most of his calf blown away, a piece of his thigh blown away, and I want to say he was a recipient of two Navy crosses, or at least I know at least one. He would be running as a regimental commander of 5th Marines when we were at Margarita back in the old Corps. We'd see him limping around in his red shorts and a t-shirt, running around for PTN. And we'd look at him like, holy shit, look at Colonel Brantner's leg, you know. But they were everywhere. And that form of discipline was still in the air. And when they, like you said, when you had two piles of shit, this is my inspection shit that I never wear, right? Yeah. This is the stuff that I wear. Because that's how they taught us to do it. And we did it that way. And so hearing him talk about those hard lessons that he learned, and also the other thing, and this is what I want to ask you for, the institutional in and out of wars, is this just part of being on the backside of 17 years of fighting, enough people around that say, yeah, that stuff's chicken shit. You know, what really matters is when you go forward. Is this just part of the institutional ebb and flow of that?
Well, I think that's part of it, but here's the other part of it, Mac, and you know this because you were in Fallujah about the same time I was. What happened as we got into Iraq and Afghanistan is, you know, the combatant commanders had their standards that we were going to train to. We all know that. So, and that trickled all the way down to your rifle companies and your squadrons and your MLBs and so on and so forth. As a result of that, you know, we then have officers, even today, that can't do a training plan, that can't do a campaign plan, because of how we were taught to train to a certain standard to meet the battlefield conditions at the time. And we just kind of let that go. This whole thing with discipline and not doing the things that Marines have done in the past, part of it is the institutional in and out of combat. But come on, Matt, we've been at this for, 17, 18 years now?
Yes.
I mean, we should know better. I mean, we should have picked up on this even when I was on active duty, even before that. I retired in 12. When I retired, we'd been at war for, 10, 11 years. And we still weren't doing the right things. And frankly, that's one of the things that I was disappointed in myself. Why I didn't push this harder. Instead of just the combatant commander needs this, this standard, why weren't we teaching our young officers and staff NCOs to do proper planning for training? We didn't do that. I would assume that hopefully it's coming back now, but we had a real issue with it. And the discipline thing, when a Marine knew that he was just training to a certain standard, there was no initiative there, Mac. He just had to meet that standard, and then he was done. It was, okay, I'm done. There's no thought process to it. There was no, what about this? If the enemy does this, then I do this. And if he then reacts to this, then I do this. We didn't do that. We stopped doing that. It came back in Fallujah. You well remember, all the way from April all to November of 2004, then we took 77 KIAs in Fallujah right. during the battle in November. And what I saw there was the real rifle companies, and most of them were, they really went back to the basics. You could tell that they had worked urban warfare, door to door, block to block, street to street, clearing houses, and their troops were very well disciplined. But then when we get back to Conus, to Mainside, be it one meth or two meth or three meth, what do? You go back, right back to the same old thing. Well, the standard for combat is this, and it's always dictated by someone else. So, yeah, it's an institutional thing, but we should know better by now.
I'm interested in also one of the things that I've heard in this discussion about discipline is that we've taken all the tools away, all the coercive tools that staff NCOs in particular used to rule the roost with. And I don't mean physical violence either, because that was an accepted part of the Marine Corps when I came in. Did it in 83. I mean, the Marine Corps, you knew putting your hands on somebody was, was the wrong thing to do. So I'm not talking about that, but have we taken all the coercive tools away from our staff NCOs in our desire to eliminate quote unquote hazing? Have we eliminated all the tools that they have, or is it simply a requirement to be better, to be smarter as we do it?
Yes and no. I think we've taken away some of the tools from staff NCOs, but they weren't always good tools. And again, you were a product of it. I was a product of it, where, if you were thumped, it didn't really make it better frame. It probably strained you out at that instant, but, I don't know about you, but I was always resentful of a staff NCO who put his hands on me or shoved me or whatever happened to me because he thought that was the proper way to do things. No, I think, especially with our staff NCOs, again, they're smarter. They're very articulate. Most of them, frankly, could be officers. You couldn't say that maybe 30 years ago. Or maybe even a little bit longer than that. But I think what we have failed to do with our staff NCOs, and I'm just going to speak for myself now, is give them the responsibility for certain aspects of their unit, whatever it happens to be. And it can be training. It can be good order and discipline. It can be the barracks. It can be weapons cleaning. It can be washing airplanes, whatever it happens to be. We kind of took that away from them. And as a result, they said, and I think you remember hearing this, if they're going to do that, this all stems from the MCRD issues back a few years back in the 70s and 80s where we right. put more officers right. down there to supervise staff NCOs, and they were going, let's let the officers do it. And I think we're kind of getting away from that. You know, what I've seen lately, maybe the last 3 or 4 years, is the staffing fields are really coming back into their own. And I think they're smarter about it. However, I will say this. I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with disciplining and marine physically, whether it's push-up or whatever it happens to be. But the staff NCO should be willing to do it along with him for showing the proper way to do it. And I think there's some of that out there now.
We're so averse to that. We're so skittish that something's going to go wrong. If we give them that permission, we know it's going to happen. Somebody's going to take it too far. And what's interesting, sir, is when young Marines that have listened to these interviews, about discipline, when they hear what you described at the start of this, when you stood duty, right, you had a 45.
Yeah.
And guys did rounds with their 45 unholstered, or they brought their German Shepherd, right, to work with them and an axe handle in addition to their 45, that there was a platoon on standby for riot duty, that there was, riots in chow halls between blacks and Samoan Marines, that there were Ku Klux Klan meetings. When they hear that stuff, it's like they don't even believe it. They're like, no way, in the Marine Corps. I mean, so it's almost like, we've forgotten some of our history about what it is to be and why we're disciplined, why we're respectful, why we do these things. But so much of the power of the Marine Corps when I was a lieutenant was resident in our staff NCOs. In fact, I had a son that was in 3-5. He just got out a month ago and he and I were talking about hazing one day and he said, it went on when you were a lieutenant. You just didn't know about it. I said, no, it didn't. And he said, why do you say that? I said, okay, my platoon sergeant, Bruce B. Smith from Washington, D.C., was 5'11" and weighed 250 pounds. Okay? When he looked at my Marines and said, nobody touches the new joints, you know who didn't get touched? The new joints. You want to know why? Because they knew that he would have their ass. And I don't mean by punching them or anything like that, but whether it would be putting them on working parties, digging a fighting position, PT, he would wear their shit out and he would waste their time and play fuck, and nobody wanted any part of that. And I looked at my son, so trust me, when he said that, the staff NCOs used to run the Marine Corps. And I just, again, very broad question about, in trying to police up some of the things that we're so skittish about. And now with social media, I mean, it is amazing to me what gets to the top of the fold in Stars and Stripes, in Marine Corps Times. There's social media issues, not issues that involve the force, issues that involve national security, issues that involve operations. It's so-and-so reservist who just left MCT with three other reservists formed a swastika. That's top of the fold news now. And so, again, I think that our staff NCOs, I think that the Marine Corps has to look at that and say, do they feel like they have the power to intervene, or am I just going to get accused of hazing this kid and I'm going to get in the spotlight? So I think that's an issue.
Yeah, but Matt, you said something and you don't even know that you said it, and you hit it right on the head. And I want everyone.
Wait a minute. What makes you think I didn't know that I said it if I said it?
No, because I know you and you didn't.
What the hell?
And I want everyone to really listen to this, hear this interview in the weeks and the months to come. What has happened is we don't talk about the Marine Corps anymore. We don't explain why we had this discipline years ago and why we need it today, especially in combat. The enemy today, I think, is a lot harder enemy adversary than it was in Vietnam. Yeah, it was head-to-head. I get all that. It was head-to-head inclusion. I get all that. But they're smarter and they're a great adversary. But we don't sit down with our Marines but we don't talk about the Marine Corps. We don't talk about its history, and we don't talk about why we are so good at what we do. It all starts with good order and discipline and everyone operating as a team. You said that, you glossed right over it, so bad on you, but that's exactly right.
See, this is what I mean. This is why everybody needs the six-step in troop leading exercised on their ass so they don't screw it up like I just did. So do you, when you have taught discipline in units, are there certain things that are, I tell a story about Lieutenant Colonel Neller calling me in when he was my battalion commander, and he said to me, he looked at me, he said, "Why are your maintenance numbers so high?" And I said, "Because I inspect every week." And he looked at me, he said, "What?" I said, "Every week we're not in the field, I inspect. Every Friday, I inspect every vehicle, I inspect my maintenance bay, I inspect every weapon, I inspect the rooms, I inspect." And he looked at me, he said, "That's it?" I said, "Yes, sir." Are there anything when you teach discipline, when you talk to, and you just talked to, you named a few of them when you talked about that meeting you had with the officers of the MEF. Are there anything that you say are hallmarks of well-disciplined organizations or things that you have to do if you're going to have a disciplined organization?
Yeah, and that's a great question, and I appreciate you asking that. First of all, I think the units that I've seen that are very, very good at what they do, and again, it doesn't matter if they're a rifle company, an MLB, an MLC, or a squadron, or what have you, you see brilliance at the basics. And I've seen that time and time and time again. And in other words, you know, they understand what is expected of them, and they are told how to accomplish that. They are taught accountability and responsibility. And they're different, you know, as we know. Some people are accountable, some people are responsible, commanders are both. But the units that I've seen that are very, very good are very good at brilliance, you know, brilliance at the basics at the brilliance, however you want to say it. So, and that really, I think, takes a young Lance Corporal coming to that unit. He knows what's expected of him, and if someone is teaching him how to accomplish that, and if he knows what he's responsible for, or if he knows what he's accountable for, or she, you're going to have a really solid unit. And I think that can be done several ways. You know, we've all seen commander's guidance, down to the company level, battalion level, so on and so forth. And that's very important. And by the way, you know, when you see commander's guidance, for the most part, it should never be, you know, more than a page long. We've all seen commander's initial planning guidance. And that could change, you know, 6 months into it, so on and so forth. I'm not so sure we do those kind of things anymore. But the good units that I've seen, and you can pick them out every time, Matt, and you can see it in combat, and you can see it in garrison, they really are very good at the basics.
I want to ask you a question that I asked General Furness. When you would do battlefield circulation, whether it be Afghanistan, Iraq, or wherever you've gone with MARSOC units, when you would do that, how long does it take you from the time you get out of a helicopter or a vehicle before you can tell if this is a well-disciplined unit or not?
Oh, about 5 minutes.
I think
you have no response. You have no response to that, do you?
No. No, everybody knows that it takes a matter of minutes before you see enough, right? The cleanliness of how Marines live, the way they carry their weapons, the way they greet people, what their uniforms look like. It takes literally minutes to form a 99% opinion about a unit. And I think most people are stunned to hear that.
And I, you know, I'm not being flip about it, but when you get off battlefield circulation, when you get off of a helicopter, you get off of an LAB or a Humvee or whatever you happen to be doing your battlefield circulation with, you've seen this. Watch the people who greet you. You know, you'll see some people with their helmet flak jacket on, some people with their flak jacket on but not zipped up all the way, some people with their weapon school-wise, some people with their weapons slung, some people with their weapon that, you know, carrying it quote arms. And you can look at their uniform, and there's no uniformity with it. You remember what General Van Racker said about, I want to make sure that I could see 39 compasses, you know,
right.
39 canteen. That's the way we would turn it also. And it always stuck with us. You can see that in unit. So when you say, how long does it take? Literally, it can take just 5 minutes. Now, I've also changed my opinion, you know, as I talk to the Marines or, you know, really got down and talking about what they're doing and why they were doing it. I didn't necessarily change my opinion about the leadership.
Next question. When you talk to leaders about leaders, and especially senior leaders, how do you affect a larger organization? Because that to me was one of the interesting when General Kelly came in one day and said, "You've got a new job." I was in Ramadi, and I said, "What's that?" He said, "You're going to be General Mattis's staff sec." And I said, "I don't even know what that is." Now, I had been off active duty for 10 years, but I had worked for Kelly at IOC in 1991. And I said, "Who do I work for?" He said, "Joe Dunford. He's the chief of staff." I said, "Oh," yeah. I said, "I don't know him." He said, "Mac," he said, "you're hopeless." He said, "Just come with me and don't screw it up." And, but I got a chance to see the Marine Corps from a perspective I'd never really seen it from, and that was from, you know, the perspective of the division commander. And I mean, talk about one of the greatest experiences of my life, to be in small rooms and small meetings with John Kelly, with Jim Mattis, with Joe Dunford, with those guys sitting around talking with Ambassador Bremer, and all the different players that played, you know, in the drama of 2004, you know, General Conway. How do you affect discipline, good order and discipline, when your echelons above, levels of command above? How do you do that?
Well, first of all, you can't do it yourself. You mentioned, you know, some of my greatest friends and commanders, if you will, when I went through the Marine Corps. As we were all commanders, you know, whether you were a battalion commander, not so much at the company level, but from the battalion command up, you know, anytime I had an issue and I was trying to steer a unit in a specific way, you know, training, good order, and discipline, and that's not easy to turn. You know, it takes a long time. But I ran with guys like Paxton, Coleman, Dunford, Kelly, Mattis, Jim Jones, Tom Jones, John Allen. And none of us were hesitant to pick up the phone and say, "Hey, you know what? I've got this issue. You know, what do you think? How did you handle this?" And I think that's one of the ways you affect change. The other one is, you know, as you're a higher echelon commander, and I'll again talk at the mess level, and it's the same for the division or the wing or the MLG. A commander has got to have a certain group of people that he or she depends upon and trust implicitly. And it can't be, you know, 15 people. That doesn't work. I'm talking about your sergeant major, your command master chief, your chief of staff, your OPSO, you know, those kind of people that we met with every morning at a stand-up at 8 o'clock. And it's exactly what it was, a stand-up for 15 minutes. And then for that day, although we had obviously a campaign plan and we knew what we were doing, so this is what I expect for the day. What do you guys expect from me for the day? So it's a two-way street. And I think if you do that, if you get that small group on board, and then that equates to getting the other staff sections on board at you know, division, wing, so on and so forth, the commanders are going to come along too because they agree with 99% of what you do. And you can actually affect the way big units operate, you know, by doing those basic things.
All right, let me ask you a final question. This is called the general question. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about discipline, about this discussion that's ongoing in the Marine Corps that you want to make sure that people know?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, Mac, because I was going to bring it up with you at the end anyway. I think the whole issue with discipline and culture is, you know, the leaders of today, and I don't care if you're the Commandant of the Marine Corps or your Lance Corporal, you know, Smith down in 3rd Battalion, 8th Marine, you have got to lead by example. And you're not a Marine from, you know, 0730 until 1700. You're a Marine 24/7, 365. I mean, that's just the way it is. And when you, when you're out in town, here's a good example for you. Is this the right thing to do? I don't know. It's just what I did. When I was a general officer, all the way from lieutenant colonel all the way to when I retired as a three star, you never saw me in the PX or the commissary in a pair of blue jeans. I was always in a pair of doctors and a shirt with my shirt tucked in and a belt and shoes and so on and so forth. Now, is that important? Yeah. I think the young troops and the young officers see that, and they expect that. So you have got to lead by example each and every day, personally and professionally. And I think if you don't do that, whether you're a corporal or a commandant of the Marine Corps, you're really letting your troops down, you're letting your unit down, you're letting your corps down, and you're letting your country down.
Something that small.
Yep.
But, and I guess it appears small until you embrace what you said about you're a Marine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. When you embrace that title like that, then it changed. I think it changed the way you have to look at it.
It does. And you and I have both seen this. How come there's so many Marines that, you know, they complain about the Marine Corps, and then for the rest of their lives, they can't think of great things about the Marine Corps?
Right.
Because at one time in their Marine Corps career, they had someone who was a mentor, someone they looked up to. And it could have been a fellow corporal, a sergeant, a gunny, or a general. You know, so that's really, really important. You've got to look at it. You know, it's not, you know, people say, is it a profession, is it a career? Hey, I say it's a lifestyle, and it's something you're going to do for the rest of your life.
My guest today in the second installment of On Discipline has been Lieutenant General Dennis Halick, United States Marine Corps retired. Sir, I can't thank you enough for doing this, and I absolutely love the discussion about leadership, about discipline. And again, if we're going to close with a near peer, make no mistake about it, right? If you're not disciplined, you're going to get it handed to you. And, and you have to live with that for the rest of your life. Nobody can lift that burden from you. So, and discipline's just part of it. So thank you. Thank you very much. And I hope, you don't mind in the future if this discussion evolves, if I call you up and bring you back on and tee it up again for you.
Yeah, absolutely, Mac. And one last thing for you and for the audience out there, for all my fellow Marines. There's a great book on leadership. It's called Forgotten Soldier. It's written by Guy Sager, S-A-G-J-E-R, World War II. And I know you probably read it, Matt.
Exactly.
When you talk about leadership and discipline, Forgotten Soldier, and I recommend everyone read it. Thank you so much for what you do.
Oh, no. If you can't tell, it's more than a little bit of fun. I invented the greatest job in the world for myself. But I heard that book at the first reading PME that I ever attended, and it was for the officers of the 5th Marine Regiment. It was given by our regimental XO, Marvin Hopgood. Did you know?
Yeah.
Did you know?
Yes.
And I was a fairly well-read young man, and I had never even heard of that book, and I was stunned. I was like, what? And so I think I went up and took it from the library in Huntington Beach and never took it back and paid the fine. and then Marty Steele took it from me. I think he has it, or the CO of 1st Tank Battalion has it. But give me another book on leadership to read, sir. There's one. Anything that you're reading currently that you would recommend to people?
I just finished, for the second time, The Story of Ray Davis by Ray Davis, you know, General Davis in Korea.
Oh, man.
You talk about a great leader. Just pick up his book and read it. And it's, you know, it's an easy read. The Old Breed, obviously. I've read that numerous times. And then one of my favorites, and I can't think of the author right now, is called The Marines of Autumn, Korea. They're talking about the Chosen. They're talking about being up on the ridgeline. It's all written at the last corporal level. So those are the big ones for me. But I think number one, especially for the young troops and our young officers, read Forgotten Soldier and then read Ray Davis.
All right. A native of Gardner, Iowa.
Right,
Dennis Alick. Not a bad run. Now, where's home now? Where's home these days, sir?
Home nowadays is Charlotte, North Carolina. That's where the grandkids are. And, you know, like most officers when you retire or sergeants, majors, you kind of go where your wife wants to go and the grandkids go there, so we're here.
All right. Well, again, thank you for doing this. And at some point, we'll do another one in the future. And have a great day, sir.
All right, Matt. God bless you. Thanks for what you do.
Thank you again, sir. That is Lieutenant General Dennis Halick, United States Marine Corps retired. And that is the second installment of a series that we're doing called On Discipline. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.